Hello, and welcome to our program, Tech and Arts, brought to you by Owl Radio and the Low Vision Resource Center. I am Harsh Madaik, and during the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from both Time Magazine as well as CNN here on Owl Radio. The first article is called Why Apple is Betting Big on India by Krutika Patti. On April 18th, 2023, from Time Magazine. Apple Incorporated opened its first flagship store in India in a much-anticipated launch Tuesday that highlights the company's growing aspirations to expand in the country. It also hopes to turn into a potential manufacturing hub. The company CEO Tim Cook posed for photos with a few of the 100 or so Apple fans who had lined up outside the sprawling 20,000 square foot store in India's financial capital, Mumbai, its design inspired by the iconic black and yellow cabs unique to the city. A second store will open Thursday in the national capital, New Delhi. India has such a beautiful culture and incredible energy, and we're excited to build on our long-standing history, Cook said in a statement earlier. The tech giant has been operating in India for more than 20 years, selling its products through authorized retailers and the website it launched a few years ago. But regulatory hurdles and the pandemic delayed its plans to open a flagship store. The new stores are a clear signal of the company's commitment to invest in India, the second largest smartphone market in the world, where iPhone sales have been ticking up steadily, said Jayanth Kola, analyst at the Convergence Catalyst, a tech consultancy. The stores show how much India matters to the present and future of the company, he added. For the Cupertino, California-based company, India's sheer size makes the market especially encouraging. About 600 million of India's 1.4 billion people have smartphones, which, quote, means that the market is still underpenetrated and the growth prospect is huge, said Neil Shah, Vice President of Research and Technology at the technology market research firm Counterpoint Research. Between 2020 and 2022, the Silicon Valley company has gained some ground in the smartphone market in the country, going from just about 2% to capturing around 6%, according to Counterpoint data. Still, the iPhone's hefty price tag puts it out of reach for the majority of Indians. Instead, iPhone sales in the country have thrived among the sliver of upper middle class and rich Indians with disposable incomes, a segment of buyers that Shah says is rising. According to Counterpoint data, Apple has captured 65% of the premium smartphone market, where prices range up from 30,000 rupees, which is about $360. In September, Apple announced it would start making the iPhone 14 in India. This news was hailed as a win for Prime Minister Narendra Modi's government, which has pushed for the ramping up of local manufacturing ever since he came to power in 2014. Apple first began manufacturing from India in 2017 with its iPhone SE and has since continued to assemble a number of iPhone models from the country. Most of Apple's smartphones and tablets are assembled by contractors with factories in China, but the company started looking at potentially moving some production to Southeast Asia or other places after repeated shutdowns to fight COVID-19 disrupted its global flow of products. Big companies got a jolt. They realized they needed a backup strategy outside of China. They couldn't risk another lockdown or any geopolitical rift altering their business. Currently, India makes close to 13 million iPhones every year, up from less than 5 million 3 years ago, according to Counterpoint Research. This is about 6% of the iPhones made globally, and only a small slice in comparison to China, which still produces around 90% of them. Last week, India's Commerce Minister Piyush Goyal said that the government was in regular touch with Apple to support their business here, and that the company had plans to have 25% of their global production come out of India in the next 5 years. The challenge for Apple, according to Shah of Counterpoint, is that the raw materials are still coming from outside India, so the tech company will need to either find a local supplier or bring their suppliers, based in countries like China, Japan, and Taiwan, closer to drive production. Still, he's optimistic that this target could be met, especially with labor costs being lower in India and the government wooing companies with attractive subsidies to boost local manufacturing. For Apple, everything is about timing. They don't enter a market with a full flow until they feel confident about their prospects. They can see the opportunity here today. It's a win-win situation, Shah said. Okay, the next article is called Big Tech is Already Lobbying to Water Down Europe's AI Rules, written by Billy Perigo, April 21st, 2023, Time Magazine. European lawmakers are putting their finishing touches on a set of wide-ranging rules designed to govern the use of artificial intelligence that, if passed, would make the EU the first major jurisdiction outside of China to pass targeted AI regulation. That has made the forthcoming legislation the subject of fierce debate and lobbying, with opposing sides battling to ensure that its scope is either widened or narrowed. Lawmakers are close to agreeing on a draft version of the law, the Financial Times reported last week. After that, the law will progress to negotiations between the bloc's member states and the executive branch. The EU Artificial Intelligence Act is likely to ban controversial uses of AI, like social scoring and facial recognition in public, as well as force companies to declare if copyrighted material is used to train their AIs. The rules could set a global bar for how companies build and deploy their AI systems, as companies may find it easier to comply with EU rules globally rather than to build different products for different regions, a phenomenon known as the Brussels effect. The EU AI Act is definitely going to set the regulatory tone around what does an omnibus regulation of AI look like? Says Amba Kak, the executive director of the AI Now Institute, a policy research group based at NYU. One of the Act's most contentious points is whether so-called general purpose AI, of the kind that ChatGPT is based on, should be considered high risk and thus subject to the strictest rules and penalties for misuse. On one side of the debate are big tech companies and a conservative bloc of politicians who argue that to label the general purpose AIs as high risk would stifle innovation. On the other is a group of progressive politicians and technologists who argue that exempting powerful general purpose AI systems from new rules would be akin to passing social media regulation that doesn't apply to Facebook or TikTok. Those calling for general purpose AI models to be regulated argue that only the developers of general purpose AI systems have real insights into how those models are trained, and therefore the biases and harms that can arise as a result. They say that big tech companies behind artificial intelligence, the only ones with the power to change how these general purpose systems are built, would be let off the hook if the onus for ensuring AI safety were shifted onto smaller companies downstream. In an open letter published earlier this month, more than 50 institutions and AI experts argued against general purpose artificial intelligence being exempted from the EU regulation. Quote, considering general purpose AI as not high risk would exempt the companies at the heart of the AI industry who make extraordinarily important choices about how these models are shaped, how they'll work, who they'll work for during the development and calibration process, says Meredith Whitaker, the president of Signal Foundation and a signatory of the open letter. Quote, it would exempt them from scrutiny, even as these general purpose AIs are core to their business model, end quote. Big tech companies like Google and Microsoft, which have plowed billions of dollars into AI, are arguing against the proposals. According to a report by the Corporate Europe Observatory, a transparency group, lobbyists have argued that it is only when general-purpose AIs are applied to high-risk use cases, often by smaller companies tapping into them to build a more niche downstream applications, that they become dangerous. The observatory's report states, general-purpose AI systems are purpose-neutral. They are versatile by design and are not themselves high risk because these systems are not intended for any specific purpose, Google argued in a document that is sent to the offices of the EU commissioners in the summer of 2022, which the Corporate Europe Observatory obtained through freedom of information requests and made public last week. Categorizing general-purpose AI systems as, quote, high risk, Google argued, could harm consumers and hamper innovation in Europe. Microsoft, the biggest investor in OpenAI, has made similar arguments through industry groups that it is a member of. Quote, there is no need for the AI Act to have a specific section on GPAI or general purpose AI. End quote. An industry group letter co-signed by Microsoft in 2022 states. Quote, it is not possible for providers of general purpose AI software to exhaustively guess and anticipate the AI solutions that will be built based on their software. Microsoft has also lobbied against the EU AI Act for unduly burdening innovation through the Software Alliance, an industry lobby group that it founded in 1998. The forthcoming regulations, it argues, should be assigned to the user that may place the general purpose AI in a high risk use case rather than the developer of the general purpose system itself. A spokesperson for Microsoft declined to comment. Representatives for Google did not respond to requests for comment in time for publication. The EU AI Act was first drafted in 2021, at a time when AIs were primarily narrow tools applied to narrow use cases. But in the last 2 years, big tech companies have begun to successfully develop and launch powerful general-purpose AI systems that can perform harmless tasks like writing poetry, while equally having the capacity for much riskier behaviors. Think OpenAI's GPT-4 or Google's Lambda. Under the prevailing business model that has since emerged, these companies license their powerful general-purpose AIs to other businesses who will often adapt them to specific tasks and make them public through an app or interface. Some argue that the EU has placed itself in a bind by structuring the AI Act in an outdated fashion. Quote, the underlying problem here is that the whole w way they structured the EU Act years ago at this point was by having risk categories for different uses of AI, says Helen Toner, a member of OpenAI's board and the director of strategy at Georgetown Center for Security and Emerging Technology. Quote, the problem they are now coming up against is that large language models, general purpose models, don't have an inherent use case. This is a big shift in how AI works. Once these models are trained, they're not trained to do one specific thing, Toner says. Even the people who create them don't actually know what they can and can't do. I expect that it's going to be probably years before we really know all the things that GPT-4 can and can't do. This is very difficult for a piece of legislation that is structured around categorizing AI systems according to risk levels based on their use case. The next article is called "An Ancient Roman Bust Purchased for $34.99 at Texas Goodwill is Headed Back to Germany," published April 23rd, 2023, by Sarah Smart, CNN. from its time in Germany during World War II to the shelves of a Texas Goodwill, a 2,000-year-old Roman bust is making its way back home. In 2018, Laura Young purchased the bust for just $34.99 at an Austin area Goodwill, unaware of its ancient history. Quote, "I was just looking for anything that looked interesting," Young told CNN last May. The bust was lent out from Munich's Glyptothek to the San Antonio Museum of Art for the past year, and the next month it'll be returned to Germany. "It's really been bittersweet," Young told CNN on Thursday. "I'm a little in denial, but I do plan on visiting him in Germany." When researching where the bust came from last year, Young was put in contact with Sotheby's, which confirmed that the bust was estimated to be about 2,000 years old. The identity of the bust is not certain yet, but the team at the San Antonio Museum of Art told CNN that they believe it resembles the Roman leader Sextus Pompey. Quote, "I, along with some other scholars who worked from the photographs of the German example after its disappearance, have suggested Sextus Pompey, based on the similarities to the portraits of his father, Pompey the Great, and to the coin that was included on the label in the San Antonio Museum of Art's exhibition of the portrait, which has a portrait of Sextus on it." Lindley McAlpine, a postdoctoral curatorial fellow at the San Antonio Museum of Arts, said, "The bust was originally housed in a replica of a Pompeii home, also known as the Pompeianum, and was moved to storage just before the building was destroyed during the war. It is then believed around the 1950s a U.S. soldier stole the bust and brought it to the U.S., which is how it eventually ended up at the thrift store and in the hands of Young. For the past year, the 52-pound marble bust has been seen by thousands of guests at the San Antonio Museum of Art, including Archduke Karl Christian of Austria and San Antonio Mayor Ron Nirenberg. May 21st will be the artifact's last day at the museum, and it'll then be shipped back to Germany. The San Antonio Museum of Art says that the bust will join two other Roman sculptures from the museum and will travel back to Germany to be together again for the first time in years. A representative from the Glyptothek in Germany will be overseeing the packing process of the artifacts and personally will shepherd them back to their home. The final article for today is called "Why Looking at Awe-Inspiring Art Could Lead to a Happier, Healthier Life," updated April 17th, 2023, by Eva Rothenberg, CNN. It may be a sunset, a stirring orchestral number, or a striking painting. Whatever gives you goosebumps or makes you shed a tear. Experts believe that consistently seeking out these awe-inspiring experiences could lead to a significantly happier and healthier life. People find awe in nature, religion, and music, as well as through visual art or architecture. We particularly feel it when we, quote, encounter things that are vast or beyond our frame of reference, and that are inexplicable and mysterious, Dr. Dacher Keltner told CNN in a video interview. And then those kinds of experiences initiate wonder and contemplation and imagination. Keltner has been studying human emotion for decades. He is also a co-founder and director of UC Berkeley's Greater Good Science Center, a research institute that probes questions about our social and emotional well-being. His latest book, Awe: The New Science of Everyday Wonder and How It Can Transform Your Life, explores the social, physical, and mental benefits of this powerful emotion. Keltner approaches awe in part from an anthropological perspective, exploring how this emotion shapes our social fabric. Quote, "As a species, we are very interdependent," he said. "But the central challenge to healthy social networks, which is vital to our health, is unbridled self-interest. The power of awe, he argues, is that it motivates us to see beyond our own desires. It, quote, quiets the voice of the self, and consequently makes you share things and collaborate with other people, Keltner said. Recently, a decades-long Harvard study found a strong link between close interpersonal connections and our overall happiness and health. But is finding wonder through art as simple as looking at a beautiful painting? Keltner says the answer is complex. In 2017, he co-authored a study mapping the self-reported emotions of over 850 participants as they watched more than 2,000 short videos. The researchers cataloged 27 emotions, some of which were more likely to co-occur and so were considered related. The study found that awe was experienced as a distinct emotion, different from beauty, although it was often reported alongside admiration and aesthetic appreciation. Keltner concludes, therefore, that it's important, albeit difficult, to differentiate stimuli that are simply beautiful from those that tend to evoke awe. He says to think of beauty as something familiar. When we look at art that fits our understanding of the world, such as bucolic landscape paintings of rolling hills, we recognize that we are seeing beauty. But Keltner argues that awe-inspiring art happens when we violate expectations, when things are out of place or turned upside down. In contrast to beauty, awe is overwhelming and mysterious. Shock value isn't enough, though. In that same 2017 study, awe rarely occurred alongside feelings of disgust, horror, fear, or anxiety. Fundamentally, what separates wonder from shock is that the former invites us to learn and grow. All this nuance means that it can sometimes be hard to recognize feelings of awe when they arise. So Keltner suggests taking careful note of various stimuli, like paintings, music, natural phenomena, and analyzing how they make you feel. Do you feel quiet? Do you feel humble? He said. All of our studies show that your sense of self recedes to the background of your consciousness as you're absorbing this perceptual experience. The small self is probably one of the defining elements of awe. Evoking awe poses a challenge to artists because it's one thing to astonish people and another to aesthetically point to new ideas, said Keltner. Artist Sepha Klein sees science and art existing in harmony with one another. While one is seen as objective and the other highly subjective, they're, quote, very similar processes, she said. There are ways for people to communicate information. In her new exhibition, Webs, Where Everything Belongs, which opened in New York on Wednesday, Klein uses materials from molten bismuth, an element rarer than gold, woven glass, plaster, and acrylics, as she invites viewers to ask metaphysical questions about human consciousness and our place in the universe. She hopes the audience can come away from her mixed media works with a sense of meaning and a recognition that, quote, everything is inextricably bound, not only on the particle scale, but also on the social scale. Through her art, she tries to communicate her own awe to the audiences. To do so, she plays with scale, both in artistic and scientific sense, drawing from the vast planetary scale of astronomy and astrophysics, as well as the microscopic dimensions of quantum mechanics, Klein strives to create a space where her viewers can arrive at their own moments of wonder. Her work incorporates radiating lines and recurring spirals, eliciting a sense of motion and drawing the viewer in. Intensely bright beams of color emanate like lasers from the reflective centers of the canvases, like lightning bolts of inspiration. From far away, audiences can appreciate the dynamism of the abstract starburst, but drawing closer, they can admire the minuscule specks of metal that look like cells underneath a microscope. Awe is seeing that you are exceeded by something else and finding peace and beauty and admiration in that fact, she said. It's a realization that once you get past a certain scale, your being as you know it stops existing. Like Keltner's notion of the small self, Klein calls this experience as a metaphorical ego death. Instead of existential dread, Klein finds comfort in that abstraction, in that mystery. When people realize the limits of their understanding, she said, they can feel like they belong to a greater sense of order in the world. Research shows that awe and wonder improve positive social behavior by helping people feel as though they are part of something bigger than themselves. One study examined people's actions after spending time in a grove of giant evergreen trees. Participants who spend 1 minute looking up at the trees demonstrated an increased tendency to help others. Another study found that consuming and creating art, whether it's music, visual art, or literature, correlates with increased empathy and civic engagement. There are a host of other benefits that make awe, as Keltner puts it, a quote, pretty good state to be in. He and other scientists have found that awe was among the positive emotions associated with less inflammation in the body, a major trigger for chronic disease. Awe has also been shown to calm our sympathetic nervous system, which activates when we feel stressed, increasing our heart rate and blood pressure. There may be mental benefits to being awestruck too, specifically, a reduction in stress and anxiety. Keltner says that people who experience wonder tend to find a greater sense of well-being and purpose in their lives, and this, in turn, makes them less self-critical. It is also associated with creativity and curiosity. To feel the full extent of these benefits, it's important for people to seek wonder in their everyday lives, even if they don't have access to galleries, concert halls, mountain peaks, or lakeside sunsets, Keltner said. Simply looking at art online could make a difference, he added. I think one of the promises of our digital lives is having access to more aesthetic awe and getting you to artists that you wouldn't normally find in a museum, he said. In 2021, Keltner and other researchers partnered with Google Arts and Culture to map the emotions that users reported when looking at 1,500 different artworks online. Of those, participants reported that some 60 artworks made them feel some level of awe. Other words they chose to describe these works were mysterious, striking, cosmic, spiritual, and intimate connectedness. One way to tune into your own sense of awe, Keltner suggests, is to explore these pieces and ask yourself what emotions they elicit in you. Most importantly, he urges people to slow down and be receptive to their surroundings. Look for things that challenge your scale, both small and vast, he said. Anything from a pattern created by flowers near the sidewalk to the silhouette of your city skyline on your commute. He promises you'll thank yourself later. You've been listening to Technology and Arts on Owl Radio. You can listen to Owl Radio on our specially tuned radio or by streaming on your computer or smartphone. You may also listen at your convenience on our podcast page at www.owlradio.org. Thank you for listening. This program will be replayed after 9 p.m. this evening. This is Harsh Madaik saying goodbye from Owl Radio.